In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com and get up to 15% off your first purchase as a member with code REBAGNEW. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAGNEW for up to 15% off your first purchase as a member.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
You're listening to The Tillage Podcast with the Irish Farmers Journal.
Hello, everyone, and you're very welcome to The Tillage Podcast. I'm Siobhan Walsh. I'm, of course, joined by Tillage editor Andy Doyle. And this week we're recording on Thursday morning, the 10th of November, 2022, just so you'll know when we get to grain prices and weather reports later on. Coming up on the show, we're going to talk weather, field work, what can be done, what can't be done. Andy has an article in challenging 15 ton on the Tillage pages. We'll hear a little bit more about that. We're wrapping up tram lines as well this week. We'll report on the CAP meetings that the Irish Farmers Journal have been holding across the country. And of course, we'll have the weather forecast and grain markets and a few more things along the way as well. Andy, fieldwork, it's been pretty much non-existent for most people, an odd few bits being done, but there might be a possibility to get work done. Things are looking a little bit brighter.
Yeah, like it always surprises me when you're seeing all of this rain and then you just drive up a road somewhere and there's a guy out ploughing and there's a one pass coming behind them. Yeah. And I have to say, in very good conditions, as in the ground ploughed up and cultivated, it just looked lovely. You know, there was absolutely nothing wrong with it. But then, you know, there is a massive difference between overall levels of rainfall that are hitting the people up along the East Coast and Midlands towards what's hitting the people in the South. You know, there's more than four times as much rain has fallen in the South. And the people down there have a lot of planting to do. I was talking to somebody in the week, and they told me that 60 to 70% of the normal winter planting is still not done in the south of the country. And, you know, that's indicative of the kind of conversations that we would often have about what's done, what's not done, etc.
Yeah. And Andy, I've been on the road a lot in the last 2 weeks, and, you know, I'm seeing a lot of crops where there's huge patches missing, you know, where crops didn't come up or where maybe they did come up and they died away with the wet. It's difficult to look out at for people who have sown. Like, I think some people who haven't sown are kind of quite happy that they haven't now, but look, it's a risk you take. And look, there is plenty of crops that were sown in really good condition as well, but it's important you know, that we acknowledge the ones that are struggling.
Yeah, the risk, Siobhan, is something that has to be calculated. You shouldn't just say, I'll chance it. You know, you have to say that at the end of a bit of analysis, like, you know, does this field hold water in places? Are there springs? Mm-hmm. Are there lots of things like that? And do I really need to have a winter crop in now? Is there a justification for taking a risk? But perhaps it's ironic also that we would normally not really get an awful lot of patching. And I see the same patching where I go. And I think we mentioned it last week out of the Northeast. We wouldn't normally see that happening in October / early November. Okay, we could say we don't get as much rainfall. But I think it's partly rainfall, but it's also partly something else, which is high temperatures. Because frequently when we get these real waterlogged conditions, it's very cold and the plant is dormant. But it's when it's trying to grow and been driven by higher temperatures, then basically it's been drowned. And that, to me, is partly what's going on this year, because these things are happening quite early. I was talking to people recently, and they were just saying that, you know, they have almost written off whole headlands at this stage. Field is okay, but the headland took a beating. And, you know, asking the question, do I risk messing the headland now? Like, there won't be a crop in it. It may look better in 2 months, 3 months, 4 months' time, but they kind of say, well, I can't have a full crop in it. But do I mess that now for the sake of trying to get the herbicides and the insecticides out on the rest of the crop? And they're the real questions and the real challenges that are there for everybody.
Yeah, absolutely. And people, of course, getting worried now as well. Crops are in, temperatures are fairly high. Insecticides, I suppose, are the first thing people are worried about. But people are, a lot of people, and I was talking to some of the Tramlines farmers this week, you know, they're worried about grass weeds as well, that they haven't got the pre-emerge on, or that they haven't got an early post-emerge on. And for some of them, it's looking like it'll be springtime by the time they get that herbicide on. So a few more dilemmas to decide on in the next while, but there probably will be an opportunity for some people to get out with herbicide and insecticide.
Oh, I would say there will, Siobhan. And again, you know, it's the conversation that you'll have with any farmer at the moment, because that's the dilemma an awful lot of people are in. There's always going to be a break in the weather at some point. The question is, will your field allow you to make the best of the break in the weather, or will the wind be blowing gale force for the 3 days that the field is dry again? These are the permanent dilemmas that are there. And, you know, we'll talk about that a little bit later in terms of where the forecast, what it's doing, what it's saying, and what it's saying into the future as well.
Yeah, definitely. And look, it's, you know, in an ideal world, we get those herbicides on earlier, we get them on pre-emerge. But look, we're heavily dependent on the weather, and we can't always get everything done by the calendar. Planting then is the next thing. You know, some of the Tramlines farmers now this week said, I'm still going to try to plant. One man saying he doesn't mind if he plants his winter barley the end of November, early December. Any thoughts on it from your end, Andy?
I wouldn't disagree with that man, but that comment is honed by the type of land you're farming and the risk that it's posing. Like, I spoke to somebody during the week. In the first 7 days of November, they recorded 87 millimetres of rainfall. Dublin Airport recorded 6.7. It makes a difference as to which of those two areas you're in terms of either getting a chance to be able to sow, or the consequences of taking a chance to sow. So, you know, those things are quite real. Siobhan, I still remember a conversation that I had with a man many years ago now, and he sowed, I can't remember, was it Christmas Eve or Stephen's Day? Mm-hmm. Standard two-row winter barley turned out 4 ton an acre.
Yeah, nothing wrong with that.
No, there's absolutely nothing wrong with it. It's not the date. It's much more the conditions. You know, we all talk about the fact that winter barley doesn't like hardship. And if it's going to get a lot of hardship. Now, it doesn't like hardship during the growing season. If you're in a dormant season where you know, nothing is happening because temperatures are cold and ground is cold, it may be able to cope with the land being wet in that type of scenario. But if it's trying to grow, if you're in an area that's warm and it's going to try to grow, that's where it gets dangerous, when the land gets very wet. Would I sow? Yes, I would sow. But and I've had this conversation with people over the past couple of weeks. I would be thinking of sowing more towards the south than the north, if conditions would allow. That's barley in particular. Oats. The decision on oats is probably slightly different. Oats is a hardy crop, and it can cope with poorish conditions. It's hardy except for if you happen to get some of these real heavy frosts that we get, frost heave, etc. But the bigger risk with oats is whether or not there's crows in the area, and are you the only one that's going to be sown? Because the buggers would clean you out, and you wouldn't sleep for probably 4 weeks trying to get the thing out of the ground and trying to keep crows off. Now, I'd also say that in the main, the crows are... seeds aren't their preferred food. You know, it's a bit like a steak eater having to take fish. You'll take it if you have to, but it's not their preferred food. But what we get a lot of is the collateral damage. They know where the bugs are in the ground. They're digging down, and unfortunately, they're tearing up the seeds and the plants in the process. And therefore we're losing them in a population, and that's largely what they do. And that's why some organic farmers work on the basis that if they feed the crows to take the hunger off them, so they're literally bringing out a 4-stone bag and putting it into a trough in the yard somewhere to feed the local crows. And when they go back onto the land, they're basically walking around looking for the dessert, and they're doing an awful lot less damage.
Yeah.
Is that 100% true? I don't know, but it makes some sense.
Yeah, hard to know, isn't it? You wouldn't be trying to attract them over to you anyway. I don't think, but I see some of the logic anyway. Look, main thing I think anyway, look, ground conditions have to be right, and this time of year we have to mind our soil and we can't be mucking in crops either. But there probably will be a good chance for some people to get some crops in by the look of the forecast, hopefully, and there'll be parts of the country where ground will be okay to sow.
Siobhan, on that before we leave it, I mean, I was chatting to some people as late as last night, and we were talking about the situation that 30 years ago, everybody planted in November and December. January was seen as the only dormant month when you wouldn't plant because nothing was going to happen for a long time. And in February, then the dilemma arose, do I plant a winter crop or a winter variety, or do I revert back to spring varieties if I get a sowing opportunity? So like we all did that years ago. And I think, you know, within those comments, we got to remember that, you know, why aren't we doing that now? Is the weather worse, or is the land different, and is the machine heavier? And these are all the things that have happened, you know, in 3 or 4 decades. And they do change how we have to assess the risk. Because when you're going out with 6-meter machines, maybe mounted on headlands, you know, you will inevitably do damage no matter what kind of footwear you put under you once the ground is wet. And this is all part of what's generating the risk. But it's also the reason why I keep saying improve the ground, improve the ground, improve the ground, because the better you can make a structure through the incorporation of organic matter, the less damage you will do if you have to traffic at those times of the year. The land is more resilient when it's better structured.
Bring back the Massey drills, Andy.
No, I mean, I know why you would say that. That isn't going to happen. But when we're... Well, look, there's probably some of them out there still working.
Oh, there is.
When we're working, the big machines were working, it's infinitely more important to be doing things that will improve the soil so that we can cope better with the weight that we're putting on it.
Yeah. Andy, that kind of leads us along to the tillage pages this week. And we're talking about tramlines on two of the pages, but you were writing about a 15-ton club on one of the pages this week. Tell us a little bit about it. Now, we want people to get the paper as well, so don't tell them at all.
Yes, Siobhan. Look, most of the younger generation of farmers won't even be conscious of what the 10-ton club was. But it originates from that idea. The 10-ton club came about at a time when there was basically winter cereals and intensive cereal production was new in Ireland. And they basically... ICI formed a 10-ton club. It happened originally in the UK and brought it here. And all it did was ask farmers what they did with their fields, put in all the inputs, and then give the yield at the end of the day. And if you had a lot of fields in a mix and you were looking at all of this information, you could say, well, people that were doing this tended to be associated with higher yields. And that's really what it was. It wasn't research, it wasn't advice, it was just learning from experience and then passing that information on, not from a singular farm but from multiple farms. But that was 40 years ago, and that was the 10-ton club. You know, genetics have moved on, everything has moved on. The vast majority of farmers will say, particularly in a year like last, but not just last year, that as they look at their yield monitors going through the field, they will pass the 6 ton an acre, 15 ton a hectare on the yield monitor as they go through different parts of the field. And that's where we were 40 years ago. We didn't have yield monitors, but people knew that certain bits of fields were infinitely better than other bits of field, and those bits were recurring on an annual basis. So the question was, you know, what's holding back the other bits? And that's a question that I'm beginning to put out there. I have little doubt in my mind that the genetics that we're planting today are well over 15 ton an acre. a hectare in terms of their capacity. You know, we have fields in Yen that have put out 6.5 and a tad with it. The world record yield for wheat, the same varieties that we are growing, is 17.3 something tons per hectare. So, you know, if we're going to be in the game in tillage, now I'm talking winter wheat so far, if we're going to be in the game of tillage, we have to be seriously looking towards those yield potentials. They are the yields that give Ireland the name of being the biggest yield producer across most crops in Europe. And we've lost that advantage for years and years and years because of how we're farming. So we need to be able to drive on that yield to produce those results. And if we can get the practical reasons behind why some people can get these results, it's a potential advantage for others to be able to do. Now, I use 15 ton for winter wheat. I'll be honest, and I think I don't see any reason why I can't use 13 tons for winter barley in the same theoretical. Well, it's not theoretical, but it'll be seen as theoretical by a lot of people now. But winter barley 10 years ago produced 13 ton a hectare in this country, two rows and six rows. And that was cassia I'm talking about. And, you know, if I go back to spring barley, I would honestly say today that that's probably 11 ton a hectare. Indeed, I spoke to somebody in the week who had, albeit a single field rather than a farm average, but a single field who far exceeded 11 ton a hectare on spring barley. The actual yield was 4.5 ton an acre from a spring barley field. So, you know, these things are real. The question is, we're spending an awful lot of time talking about the husbandry of getting the lower yields that we're talking about. We should be spending a lot more time about talking about the things that are holding back our yield potential. And if we get up on 11 ton of spring barley, a 13 ton of winter barley, 15 ton of winter wheat, the 1 euro or 50 cents you might save between product A and product B will matter an awful lot less when you spread it across more tons. Yeah, I'm saying talk about the things that really matter to where we need to be to survive in tillage.
Yeah, and Andy, I like the way you put that, because you said the things that are holding back yield potential. You know, you don't need to get this 15 ton by applying more nitrogen. You know, it's the things that are holding you back at the minute. It's the things that aren't letting the nitrogen that you're applying at the minute work as efficiently as it should be. You know, it's getting your soil right, getting your timings right on your applications and everything as well, isn't it?
Siobhan, you're 100% right. Like, I would honestly say that if you get to a 15 ton yield potential field, you will have to use less nitrogen than you're using today, because you won't get 15 tons unless you've changed other aspects of husbandry to deliver a higher yield potential. That they all hinge around improving the soil, improving the organic matter content of the soil, the physical structure of the soil, etc., etc. And, you know, if I can give some of my own personal experience, and I don't say these things too often, but up to 2005, I was a continuous wheat grower. And I've often said to people that if I could average 3.8 tons dry year on year, I would feel I was doing pretty okay. And this would be in a conversation where people would be talking about much higher yields than what I was admitting that I could achieve. Generally, the truth came after 12 o'clock at night around the bar, and the numbers changed fairly dramatically. But I set myself the task of increasing my yield by a ton an acre post 2005 in the next cap, went back to rotation, etc., went back to trying to do things differently and to ultimately decrease the cost of production along the way. I actually said I wanted a ton more wheat and to spend 100 euro an acre less doing it. Okay. I'll talk about the yield first. I got the yield. I introduced a six-year rotation. We went from 3.8 dry to the best single yield I got in there across the wheat was 4.99. So I didn't get 5 ton. That was a target. I didn't get it. But they're 15% moisture adjusted yields. In doing that, at that stage, I was on 25 to 30 kilos of nitrogen less per hectare because I had a rotation going. I put in beans originally with rape in the rotation, couldn't keep both there because volunteer rape in beans became a big problem for me at that time. And I'd end up with rape every third year, and that would effectively kill it as a low cost crop for me. So I had to pull out rape, and I went back to more oats in the equation. And oats was a worry because the farm had a lot of wild oats. But from continuous work over 30 plus years, I can honestly say that wild oats had gone as a problem. It wasn't gone completely as a weed, but it was gone as a problem, even in oats. So that meant that we were getting on okay. So we were able to do that. But I have to say, I went through one whole wheel in the rotation, 6 years, when I never really got a kick out of yield. So I had only first wheats, but I was still only getting 4.1, 4.2. That wouldn't encourage you to give up a continuous wheat. And it's only when I brought in straw chopping and then brought in organic manures, chicken litter in particular, we brought in both litter and pellets. And they really gave a kick. That was when it kind of went from the 4.2 to knock on the door of fives. So yeah. It's so much of it is to do with everything that happens in the soil, and soil improvements are not instant. That's the point that I'm making. You can't just do something today and expect 5 ton tomorrow, but or 6 ton tomorrow. You're not going to get 6 ton tomorrow if you don't start doing something today, and that's the problem.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, I think people will look forward to reading that page, Andy, this week. On the rest of the tillage pages, we have from the tramlines is coming to an end this week. So we have a summary from the 12 farmers and we get their highs and lows of the year. And just I'd like to take the opportunity on the podcast to thank those 12 farmers sincerely for all their time and effort on tramlines. And Stephen started off the year on tramlines and got a great group of farmers together. And, you know, they really were. I think it's an important page in the paper, Andy, because, you know, they're very honest. They tell us when things are going well and when they're not going so well. And I think that's very important for the wider readership, you know, to know that things aren't going smoothly on other people's farms as well. You know, it's good to hear about all the great stories and the good yields, but it's maybe more important to know that you're not the only one that's running to bother with something.
Things go wrong for good farmers too. And Siobhan, if I could echo that by equally saying a thanks to all the farmers that have participated in Tramlines for us throughout the, I don't know how many years we're doing it now, but there's been a lot of people involved, and to say a personal thanks to all of them, because as you rightly say, it's the honesty with which things are stated and delivered that makes the other readers feel that, you know, we're all normal. I'm not a failure because a crop failed. You know, things happen to everybody. So well done to that. And Siobhan, when we're talking about that, you know, what were the highs in particular and the lows in particular of the lads for 2022?
Like, I think it's great to have such a spread on those farmers, because, you know, most people's high was, oh, the weather, great harvest. It was so easy. You know, the weather just made it such an enjoyable harvest. And then you go further north, and it's, yeah, it was an okay harvest. It was a fair enough or whatever. Yields were fairly okay, you know. So different parts of the country tell very different stories on the highs and the lows. Look, the lows for many, I suppose, are the high input costs, you know, and that's fair enough to say. And to be honest as well, there's some there, you know, who are saying the back end of the year and not getting crops in. And talking to the farmers this week, I certainly, Andy, you were talking to some of them as well, but, you know, you could certainly hear it in them that they're very disappointed that they didn't get winter crops in. And there's an awful lot of tillage farmers out there like that now. You know, they're disappointed that they haven't those crops in. And I suppose they know they have a lot of work ahead in the springtime as well. But look, you have to look at the silver lining on that as well. I was saying to some of them, the other side of it is maybe you'll have an opportunity to get some crops in still and have missed the bulk of the rain. Now, we don't know that. We don't have a crystal ball on the weather forecast, but you have to look at some sort of silver lining on these things as well.
Yeah, because if the field, if you think the field is worth a chance, like I spoke to somebody yesterday, that was the question, will I sow or not? And I asked them about the field. Like, half the field is dead easy and safe. The other half is dangerous. It's more likely to catch water. And the question is, will you split the field? And the answer was no. I always keep the field working the same way. And then I said, look, don't take the risk. Half the field being bad is far too big of a risk. And that's the question that everybody will kind of ask. And Siobhan, when we're saying this, I know also that there's a big worry down south, for example, amongst the merchant trade, that if winter crops don't get in, that there's going to be an awful avalanche of grain. And the challenge will be coping with that come the springtime. So, you know, talk to your merchant and see, is there any incentive to try and have some grain that you can deliver early?
One thing I noticed about the tramlines as well, Andy, like you were saying, you know, they're trying to improve efficiencies, trying to improve their soil. There's a lovely picture there on that page of Seamus Duggan's catch crop. And I think, you know, catch crops are something that really took off this year. And we have a piece of news there from Walter Furlong. He said that the area that they have planted catch crops down in the Cooney Furlong customer base has doubled this year. So it went from 8,000 hectares to 16,000 hectares, which is really amazing. And, you know, Walter put some of that down to the stubble cultivation rules, and that when people went, you know, with the disc or whatever it was, they put the seed out at that time as well. Walter was talking at the KPMG report launch. So we have that's in your paper as well this week. We have the agribusiness report. So KPMG did an agribusiness report for the Irish Farmers Journal. The results of that are all in the paper this week. The report is there. And just something I picked up from it, Andy. So there was a survey done around five towns and how they add to the country's economic output. And 17% of the cereal area in Ireland is located within 30 kilometres of Enniscorthy, which, you know, is mad to hear. And we look in that news story, you'll see there how many jobs. There's over 6,000 jobs, I think nearly 7,000 jobs in agriculture around that 30 kilometre radius of Enniscorthy. And the report is really interesting. The five towns surveyed were bringing €5 billion to Ireland's national economic outlook and 41,000 jobs in the hinterland of those towns and within those towns. So, you know, it's a really interesting report to read, and I'd encourage anyone to get the paper and have a look at that report. But that was something that Walter was at the launch of the report. He was representing Enniscorthy at the launch. And I just thought that was an amazing figure, Andy, to say that the catch crops have doubled in area this year.
Siobhan, can I make a comment on that? And it is that, you know, over the past big number of decades, we've seen Europe coming in and, you know, the major consensus is that they interfere with farming practice. And that's kind of the natural reaction that a lot of people would have. But I have to stand back and say that there's been quite a number of incentives and initiatives brought in by Europe and or the department to encourage good farming practice through the provision of some bit of support to try and do it. And catch crops is just one of them. And I think also, I believe what's also happening now is that a lot of people, maybe with the help of good harvest and earlier planting, but they see real advantage from the catch crops that they have sown with the support of GLOSS or whatever over recent years. And they're now prepared to go beyond that, but from the point of view of the benefit of the ground and also to try to physically make a contribution to reduce loss of nitrate, because they're also recognizing the fact that I put on these nutrients and I want to try and keep as many of them as I can in the field long term. That type of acknowledgement is much more real now than it was, five years ago anyway. And equally, the tree crop rule, it was cursed from a height and still is by a few. But there'd be very few people today who want to go back from using rotation because they see the benefit of it. Like a lot of these things, they were driven by regulation and policy, but not all regulation and policy is bad. And sometimes it takes us a few years to actually recognize the fact that these things are fundamentally good and they're decreasing the cost of production and making land better or more resilient over time. That's still good for farming, and we shouldn't forget that.
That's a really important point to make, Andy. Elsewhere in the paper, look, there's reports there. Barry Murphy has some reports from the CAP meetings in Carlow. Those CAP meetings are continuing. The last one is next week in Cavan. I was in Galway last night, Andy. You were in Carlow last week. And look, Carlow was the main tillage meeting, I suppose. And a lot of people had things to say in Carlow.
Yeah, Carlow, look, I was at two of them, Siobhan. I was down in Cork as well the previous week. And I would regard them as good meetings. Good meetings because people heard from the department what was going on. They heard from the different people in the journal as to what the impact of these things would be on real farmers. Now, look, at there are lots of small farmers, but in the tillage end, you know, if you're serious in it, you do probably have quite a number of hectares in tillage. And depending on what the value of your entitlements are, you literally could have a situation where you could be down between 3,000 and 7,000 euro a year with the new regime. And that's just on income support from the CAP. You know, leave aside what might happen, land rental and all the other things that are in the mix. And then for the guys that are kind of the more commercial guys on bigger acreages and reasonable entitlement values, it's quite likely that a lot of those will be back more than 10,000 a year. And if you're unlucky enough to be one of the ones that's caught by capping, I used an example where somebody was going to be down over 60,000 a year in terms of support income over the next, from next year onwards. And, you know, they're serious numbers. That type of scenario will fundamentally change the type of business that people will operate going forward and question the value of accessing land. Certainly it'll question the value, probably more so, of accessing entitlements going forward, depending on what the land might cost. So, you know, a lot of things are going to come out of it. The thing that we talked about across all the enterprises is how land rental will be handled in future. And a comment that kept coming from the department people on the top table was that any rental agreement, particularly any lease agreement, should have the entitlements completely divorced from the rental agreement, so that in the event of another change in policy, that you will not be locked into a scenario where you owe people back the entitlements that you leased, which have changed in value for the farmer in the meantime when it comes to 2023. Because that's a dilemma that a number of people have today. They're renting in entitlements at whatever value, but in the year that's coming, they're not going to get the BIS element of those entitlements, because you can only get a BIS payment on 30 hectares, and these guys could have 300 hectares. And if they're also caught by capping, then, you know, there's quite an amount of the income from the entitlements that will not be available to those growers in the years ahead. So what's going to happen? Existing rental lease arrangements. So look, that's a big challenge. There are always challenges there. At the meeting, Siobhan, just one point, I suppose, that was made, and it was a comment that was it picked up probably the only real round of applause from a question for the night, and that was that, you know, the tillage sector is being beaten hard in all of these arrangements. You know, no matter which way you look, we have a pesticides on the one hand, we have ongoing convergence. Now, I know everybody has ongoing convergence, but tillage has ongoing convergence with nobody in the tillage sector kind of picking up any benefit from the losses that others would be succumbing along the way. I can remember back to the first CAP when there was a lot of debate for a while, payment-based cap in 93, when the entitlements on tillage farms were based on the average spring barley yield in the preceding years. And there was a lot of argumentation that, you know, it should really be based on average farm yield, but we couldn't verify our average farm yields at the time. So everybody was compensated on the basis of spring barley, even if you were a winter wheat or a winter barley grower, or you had much higher yields than the average spring barley yield. And that was where the entitlement value ultimately came from in history. It was based on that multiplication, based on the average yield. So, you know, Tillage farmers at that stage, I said it earlier when we were talking about the 15-ton club, at that stage, we had amongst the highest yields in the world for most crops. And we were lucky we had them because that formed the basis of the entitlements. If we were doing the same exercise today, the yield level would be higher. But in comparison to other people in Europe, we would not be faring nearly so well. So look, they were the things that were said. As I said, the comment that the tillage farmer is continuously being beaten by regulations, it was the one that I think resonated with an awful lot of people in the room, because there were a lot of people there that were either mixed farmers or tillage only farmers. And Siobhan, was there anything in particular then in the Galway meeting last night?
Yeah, well, I'd also, what I picked up from those meetings as well was, you know, it's not just the tillage farmers who are saying the tillage farmers are being beaten. You know, it's an acknowledgement from the other sectors as well. And I heard that in Cork and I heard it in Galway last night, you know, people coming up to you after it and saying, tillage, you know, is getting a bad time out of this cap and is going to struggle over the next few years. Like, and, you know, say, you know, two people came up to me after the meeting last night and they just said, sure, tillage farmers who are renting land are just going to have to stop, aren't they? That was their immediate reaction to what they had heard. So I think that's important too, that, you know, that the other sectors are acknowledging that as well and worried about the tillage sector.
Siobhan, for you or I, as we make presentations, like, you're conscious of the fact that we're using numbers in examples, as in farm sizes in examples, that are much higher than average. But the bottom line is, you can't be a tillage farmer with small acreages. You just can't afford the overheads, the machine overheads that are involved. And for a lot of people in the less intensive areas, you know, the number of contractors supplying services to give you an alternative are getting fewer and fewer as well. So no matter how way it goes, you know, it's very hard to operate tillage on a small basis, because there's no contractor going to gear up just to do the couple of bits that you want done if he doesn't have a lot of other customers doing the same thing.
Yeah, and that's something the government are going to have to seriously look at, because there is a lot of small tillage farmers out there. You know, there's most of the tillage, about half of the tillage farmers are hovering around those 30 hectares. For the tree crop rule, are they growing two crops? So there's a lot of small tillage farmers out there, and they're really going to be hit badly by convergence, and they're maybe not going to be able to get into acres. And, you know, the straw scheme, and, you know, while it's good, it's not bringing an extra income. It's maybe helping the market, but it's not bringing you an extra income. To, you know, if you were selling straw. Anyway, Andy, I'm conscious of time. We're getting near the end of the show, so I think we should probably move on to grain markets, Andy. I think they were in the red yesterday evening when I checked.
Siobhan, they were in the red yesterday evening as we're talking this morning at 9 o'clock ish. The markets haven't opened yet, but I can guarantee you they're going to go into the red again today as well. Red basically means we're looking at falling prices. Yeah, last week when we spoke, I think we recorded on Wednesday evening, and we were looking at prices kind of having been up in the 350s, and they lost 17 euro that day, last Wednesday. They floated then around the 335, 336 mark for a number of days, and on Tuesday evening, they dropped again. They dropped again yesterday. So we've moved kind of from a scenario where December 22 wheat is up around 356. Last night it closed at 328. That's being somewhat reflected in physical prices, but not totally. And for a number of people now as well, there are people asking questions about next year. you know, wondering, should we be selling forward for next year, wondering what's going to happen to the market and where the pressures are and all. And again, to just mention the December 23 prices, which have a really big bearing on any price offers that might be out there. But I think if I'm remembering correctly, last week they would have been up in the mid to high 20s, if not even up into 230, 232, might have been the top end of it. Last night, those December 23 prices closed at 312. And to some degree, I suppose, they reflect a price offer that I saw from Derrygo last night for 305 for dry wheat for November 23. So, you know, markets have weakened. What's going on, I think, Siobhan, I think it's the major driver, is that, well, we know last week it was the major driver when Russia pulled out of the Black Sea corridor and then came back in again. And they came back in again with an assurance that they would not interfere with grain movements out of the Black Sea. And that was kind of a big statement, because that kind of said, well, look, okay, that means that they're not going to disrupt anything for the remainder of the current agreement, and the current agreement closes, I think, on the 22nd of this month. But it would also indicate that they were quite willing to extend it, which is what the UN is looking for, to extend this agreement into next year. You know, that's an indication then that the Black Sea corridor will remain open, and therefore there is less pressure on availability and less pressure for prices to be high. At least that's how people perceive it. The question is, will people sell at those low prices, at those lower prices? And you know, the other things that remain to be seen as to whether or not that. But now, all of a sudden, the dry price is very expensive relative to what the green price was.
And I don't have any prices this week from anyone in Andy. We might move on to weather. So
That's okay, Siobhan. Just before I leave markets, the only thing that I would say is, again, is that I see rape prices for next year continue to hold up reasonably well, you know, better than I would have anticipated. Excuse me. So if somebody hasn't sold, you might still do worse than think of trying to see, could you lock in rate prices for next year. Okay. Price last night was 639.50. That had been back to something in the order of 606 some time ago. It had also been up to 640 and knocking on the door of 650 in recent weeks. But you know, it's important to be there. That's not the price you'll get, but that price has a very strong influence on the price you get if you're trying to lock in going forward. So that's just that. I just needed to say that in passing. Weather, Siobhan. Look, we're being told every night that there's rain in the forecast, and that's pretty much the way the forecast looks for the week ahead. But the forecast is extremely variable for regions, and more so maybe even than it has been in recent weeks. And in line with the question that we were posing earlier about, you know, to sow or not to sow, there may very well be significant sowing opportunities there for people this week or in the coming 7 days along the east coast, possibly the northeast coast and the Midlands. Beyond that, there may very well be a bit too much rain, maybe the southeast, but the southeast could be a bit more variable. But like if I just give you kind of one of the low figures on the east coast for the week ahead, we're looking at a zero for today, a one for Friday, then 0, 0, 0, a four for Tuesday, and a three for Wednesday. Now, they may or may not be the numbers that apply to any individual on a given day. But it's basically saying there's really not a lot of rain in the forecast. That's 8 mil for the week ahead. You know, you can gamble against that kind of number. The question is, though, if it's dry enough, what is the forecast for the next 2, 3, 4 weeks? And that's something that we can't not consider as well. The northeast also staying quite dry in the short term, bit more rain there for next week. But a lot of the other areas, there is more rain in them. And, you know, the forecast talks about the rainfall that's there for the west, you know, rainfall mainly in the west, mainly in the northwest. And northwest actually is not too bad, but there's not going to be any much sowing opportunities, and probably little enough to take out potatoes either. But if I just give you the equivalent numbers for the west coast for the next 7 days, it's 15 mil, 14 mil, 18 mil, 0, 24, 5 and 15. You know, that's flood type territory in terms of what that means over there. Look at that. That's kind of indicative of roughly what's there. For where most of the winter grain is still to be done, there could well be opportunities that people might think of. The other thing that's there is that wind speeds are remaining fairly high. So if you're not getting rain, you're getting a good bit of wind. Everybody is commenting at how well ground is soaking. And the reason ground is soaking well in early November is that the ground is still warm. When the ground cools, it's much more difficult for water to get through and get out, because it just slows down the movement of water. But if it's warm and there's wind blowing, you do tend to get either but a lot of soakage and a lot of surface drying. And they can kind of work with you if we're lucky enough to get those conditions on the fields that you're farming. The other one, of course, that everybody is talking about at the moment is air temperatures. And, you know, it has been quite mild overall for the last number of days. And I'm looking at maximum temperatures today, looking into the next week, 16s, 15, 15, 15, 15, 13 and 10. So a change coming maybe in a week or so, but temperatures remaining considerably high for the week ahead. Nighttime temperatures, though, changing a little bit as we get into next week. We go down from 14 forecast for the temperature tonight as a minimum temperature, but then going back to 11s, 8s, 6s and 2s into next week. So a change for nighttime, a bit of a change for day. But Siobhan, I hadn't looked at it for a while, but because so many people are asking about, you know, would you sow and would you not sow? And I will always say you have to have conditions to sow and you have to have a reasonable chance that you're not going to get waterlogged in the next month. And that's an almost impossible question to answer or deal with. But I took a look today at Metairn's monthly forecast, and it's a really good forecast. It doesn't claim to be accurate, but it gives you, in a sense, a picture of the evolving weather for the next month. And that can be very useful. And I think it's particularly useful today. So I'm just going to give you some of the things that are on it, if we can afford the minute or two. Basically, for the next week, from tomorrow onwards, the weather is still dominated by low pressure, bringing higher than usual rainfall amounts, but predominantly to the west and south. And that's what I'm saying, that, you know, that this week's forecast we have dealt with. This is next week's forecast suggesting that the rainfall amounts might not be that high at all across eastern or northeastern areas. Temperatures warmer than normal, that's to continue, especially in the eastern side. Then running on to the week beginning Friday the 18th of November, low pressure still dominating predominantly in the northwest. The anti-cyclone conditions in Europe dominating much of the south and the east of the country, high temperatures persisting, wet weather likely in Ireland, but particularly again in the northwest. So now we're a fortnight we're 3 weeks from today in making those comments. We're a fortnight from today. Yeah, but the first week is covered on the double. So going on then to week three, beginning the 25th of November, week three looking like a drier week overall, and that's across the country. Temperatures remain on the high side, and that's as much as you can say, but that's useful information if you're going to take a gamble on planting a crop of winter grain. And week four then, so now we're in December, no strong signal for week four, so less than certain of how it's going to evolve, but the warmer signal remains in place, and the east and southeast trending towards drier weather. So, yeah. You know, would you take a gamble if I had really good conditions based on those and I had to get a field planted? My guess is I would, yes.
Look, some positivity in the forecast anyway, Andy, which is good to hear, and thanks very much for that. Time is against us, so we better wrap up for the week. Look, keep an eye on that weather forecast. Keep an eye on soil conditions, and of course, keep an eye on yourself. Thanks for listening, and keep the tillage flag flying.
We hope you enjoyed this Irish Farmers Journal podcast. You can find all our podcasts at farmersjournal.ie/podcast and on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.